5. Hours later, Frankie was still lying on her cot, trying not to cry or vomit, wishing she'd never joined the army, when the door to the hooch banged open. In walked a pair of women in blood-splattered clothes, a black woman with closely cropped hair who wore shorts, a t-shirt, and combat boots, and a tall, olive-oil-thin redhead in stained fatigues. Frankie figured they were both older than she was, but not by much.
"Look at that, Babs! New blood,"
Olive Oil said, unbuttoning her olive-green blouse, tossing it aside. There was blood on the woman's bra. She walked forward, clomping her boots, unconcerned about her state of undress.
"I'm Ethel Flint from Virginia. ER nurse."
She reached for Frankie's hand, shook it aggressively, like cocking a rifle.
"This here is Barb Johnson, surgical nurse from some one-stoplight town in Georgia. She's mean as a dang snake. She made the last girl cry on a regular basis."
"That isn't true, Ethel, and you know it," the black woman said, pulling the damp t-shirt away from her chest.
"Good God, it's hot."
Frankie stared at Barb. Honestly, she didn't know many black people. Something about the way Barb stared back, her eyes narrowed and assessing, made Frankie feel like a kid who'd wandered into the wrong classroom.
"I'm Frankie McGrath," she said.
Her voice gave out halfway through the introduction, and she had to start over.
"Well, Frankie, ditch the uniform,"
Ethel said, stripping off her bra and putting on a V-necked olive drab t-shirt that revealed the silver beaded chain of dog tags around her neck.
"There's a turtle party in your honor."
Barb snorted. "Hardly, Ethel. Don't give the kid a false impression."
"Well, maybe that's a bit of a stretch, but we have two turtles in today and one guy going home."
"What's a turtle?" Frankie asked.
"You are, kid,"
Ethel said, sounding old and tired and worn out.
"Now move your behind. I'm thirsty as hell. It's been a long day, and I surely could use a Coca-Cola."
Frankie wasn't used to stripping in front of strangers, but she didn't want her roommates to think she was a prude, so she began to undress. It wasn't until she was down to her undergarments that she realized she had nothing in her duffel or overnight bag to put on except her crisply folded new green fatigues, which she'd been told to wear for work, or her pajamas, or a pale blue summer dress that her mother had convinced her would be perfect for her days off, or her white nurse uniform.
"A girdle,"
Ethel said with a sigh. She opened a drawer and rifled through it, pulling out a pair of cut-off shorts and an army t-shirt and tossed them to Frankie.
"Don't worry, it's not just you. They don't tell us the truth about what to wear over here."
"Or anything else," Barb said.
Frankie peeled off the girdle and rolled down her cinnamon-hued stockings. She stood there for a second, feeling her roommate's scrutiny, then quickly put on the borrowed clothes. The t-shirt was huge and hung to the top of her thighs, almost covering the cut-off jean shorts once Frankie rolled over the waistband to make them fit. Opening her duffel, she found her flak jacket and army-issued steel pot helmet and slipped into the sleeveless jacket, immediately felt its weight. The helmet fell down and covered her eyes.
"It's a party," Barb said. "Not a John Wayne movie. Take that shit off."
"But..." Frankie turned too fast. The helmet clanked hard onto the bridge of her nose. Hurt.
"Regulations state..."
Barb walked out of the hooch. The door banged shut behind her. Ethel gently took Frankie's helmet off, tossed it on the bed.
"Look, I know today is a lot. We will help you fit in, I promise. But not now, okay? And as for the flak jacket, just... no, okay?"
Frankie undid the flak jacket and tossed it aside. It landed on the helmet on her cot. She felt exposed and ridiculous in an oversized t-shirt that hid her shorts and showed her bare legs and shiny, brand-new combat boots that she'd polished obsessively. Why hadn't she packed sneakers? Had the men who wrote the "what to bring" section of the information packet even been to Vietnam? She'd had her hair cut in a Twiggy-inspired pixie for her tour, and now, after 38 hours of travel and this hellish humidity, God knew she must look like she was wearing a black swim cap, or like she was 12 years old.
Ethel walked fast, talking as she went.
Welcome to the 36th, Frank. Can I call you Frank? This is technically a mobile hospital, but we haven't gone anywhere in a while. Instead, we keep getting bigger. We have several doctors and four surgeons. You'll know them instantly. They think they're gods. There are 9 of us women nurses and a couple of male nurses and lots of medics. In most wards, the hours are 0700 to 1900 hours, 6 days a week, but we're short-staffed right now, so really we go until the last casualty is taken care of. If it sounds like a lot, it is, but you'll get used to it. Hurry up! You're lagging!
In the falling darkness, Frankie couldn't see much of the place. A row of shacks, the hooches, a large wooden building that housed the mess, the nurses' latrines, a chapel, a row of Quonset huts that were weakly illuminated, the hospital insignia painted on their exterior walls. Ethel rounded the corner of a Quonset hut, and suddenly they were in a wide-open space, a patch of red dirt surrounded by shadowy structures. All of it looked hastily constructed, temporary. Not far away, close enough to hear the whoosh of the tides, lay the South China Sea. Pale light glazed a coil of concertina wire that created a perimeter for the camp. Off to the left was a sandbagged bunker, its entrance a gaping black square beneath a wooden arch, upon which someone had spray-painted Officer's Club on the crossbeam. A curtain of multicolored beads shielded the interior from view. Ethel pushed through the curtains. The beads made a soft clattering sound. The place was bigger inside than it looked. Against the back, there was a plywood bar with stools in front. A bartender stood behind it, busily making drinks. A Vietnamese woman in pajama-like pants and a long tunic top carried a tray from table to table. A stereo system boasted huge speakers. Beside it, there were hundreds of 8-track tapes. Like a rolling stone blared into the space, so loud people had to shout in conversation. A trio of men threw darts at a dartboard on the wall. Smoke filled the air, stung Frankie's eyes. Men and a few women filled the room, sitting at tables, standing along the walls. One guy was standing on his head with his bare legs crossed. Most were smoking and drinking. When the song ended, there was a beat of silence. In it, Frankie heard snippets of conversation, bits of laughter, someone yelling, "No love lost there, man!" Ethel clapped her hands to get attention.
"Hey, all! This is Frankie McGrath. She's from..."
Ethel turned.
"Where are you from?"
"California."
"Sunny California,"
Ethel said. She pulled Frankie forward, introducing her to the other officers. Patty was near the bar, smoking a cigarette, playing cards with a captain. She smiled and waved. Suddenly, the music changed. Out came, "East Coast girls are hip." People clapped, yelled out, "Welcome, Frankie!" A man pulled her into his arms, started dancing with her. He was tall and lanky, good-looking, in a white t-shirt and worn Levi's. His beach sand blonde hair was regulation short, but the smile on his face and the marijuana cigarette in his mouth told her that he was the kind of guy her father had told her to stay away from. Well, really, that was all men.
"War bachelors, Frankie. Married men who think love's a free-for-all when bombs are falling. Don't you go all that way and shame us."
He exhaled the sweet smoke in a rush and offered her the joint.
"You want a hit?"
Frankie's eyes widened. It wasn't the first time she'd been offered marijuana. She had gone to college, albeit a Catholic one. But this was Vietnam. War. Serious times. She hadn't smoked marijuana at the San Diego College for Women, and she sure as heck wouldn't do drugs here.
"No thanks, but I'll take a..."
Before she could say coke, an explosion rocked the O Club. The walls rattled, dirt rained down from the ceiling, a footlocker crashed to the floor, someone shouted,
"Not now, Charlie, I'm drinking!"
Another explosion. Red light flashed through the beaded curtain. A red alert siren blared across camp. A voice came out over the loudspeaker.
"Attention all personnel, take cover. Security alert condition red. We are under rocket attack. Repeat, condition red, take cover."
Rocket attack? another explosion, closer. The beads swayed and clattered. Frankie wrenched out of whoever he was his arms and headed for the door. He grabbed her, pulled her back. She panicked, screamed, tried to wrench free. He held her close. Someone cranked up the music as dirt rained down on them all.
"You're safe, McGrath,"
the man whispered in her ear. She felt his breath on her neck.
"At least as safe as anywhere in the damned country. Just breathe. I've got you."
She heard the rockets flare and explode, felt the ground shimmy under her feet. Frankie flinched at every explosion. "Oh, God, what have I done?" she thought of Finley. "Regret to inform you, no remains."
"I've got you,"
the man said again as her breathing sped up. He tightened his hold.
"Don't worry."
The siren sounded again. She felt the man's hold on her ease, felt his tension soften.
"That's the all clear," he said.
And when another explosion sounded, he laughed and said,
"That's us, giving it back to them."
She looked up, embarrassed by her fear. What kind of soldier was she? Standing here, shaking and ready to cry on her first day? "But the bunkers, shouldn't we go?"
"What kind of host would I be if I shoved you out of your own party because of a little mortar attack? I'm Jamie Callahan, chest cutter from Jackson Hole. Just look at me, McGrath. Close out the rest."
Frankie tried to focus on her breathing, on his kind, sad blue eyes, tried to pretend she wasn't terrified.
"You're a doctor?"
she made herself say. He smiled, and it showed her at last that he was young. Or at least not old. Maybe 30.
"Yep. Ward 5. Surgical."
He leaned close.
"Maybe you'll work under me."
She heard the sexy slur of his voice and smelled the alcohol and marijuana on his breath and the strange, shifting, exploding world righted for a moment, became as familiar as a doctor hitting on a nurse.
"My dad warned me about guys like you."
The explosions stopped.
"That's it,"
Jamie said with a smile, but something about it was wrong, as if maybe he'd been scared too. Someone cranked up the music. "These boots are made for walking." The crowd joined in, sang along, paired up and started dancing. Just like that, the party was back in full swing, with people smoking and drinking and laughing as if they hadn't just been bombed. Jamie smiled.
"How about a shot of whiskey, California girl?"
Frankie had trouble finding her voice.
"I don't know."
She'd turned 21 a few months before, but she'd never drunk hard alcohol. He leaned close.
"It'll stop the trembling."
Frankie doubted that.
"Will it?"
He gave her a sad look.
"For tonight, it will."
6. The next morning, Frankie woke disoriented, uncertain where she was. Then the smell hit. Shit and fish and rotting vegetation. And the heat. She was drenched in sweat. Her sheets smelled sour. She was in her sauna hot hooch in Vietnam, with a pounding headache. She sat up and swung her legs over the side of the cot. For a terrible minute, she thought she might vomit. She'd had 2 shots of whiskey last night. 2. And nothing to eat. The last thing she remembered was dancing with Ethel to Monday Monday. Had Frankie's shorts fallen down at one point, pooled around her shiny new combat boots? She thought so. Thought she remembered someone saying, "Nice gams, Frank," and Ethel laughing as Frankie struggled to pull the shorts back up. Oh, God, way to make a good first impression. Where were Barb and Ethel? Feeling shaky, dehydrated, she scratched her short hair and looked around. A large gray rat sat on the dirty wooden floor, holding a half-eaten candy bar in his pointy pink paws. At her look, he stopped nibbling and stared back at Frankie through black, oil-drop eyes. Tomorrow morning, she'd throw something at him. Now she felt too weak to expend the effort. Frankie got out of bed, ignoring the rat, who was now ignoring her too, and dressed in her creased olive green fatigues, taking care to tuck her pants into her spit-shined new boots. The rat scurried across the wooden floor and disappeared behind the dresser.
Okay,
Frankie said, standing in the small, crowded space.
You can do this.
She'd eat something and drink plenty of water and report for duty. She would drink water only from the Lister bag and take her malaria and diarrhea medications on time. Outside, she saw that the compound was a sprawling complex of buildings, all set on a mostly treeless patch of rich red earth. There were buildings and shacks and huts and tents. The Quonset huts that housed the wards looked like giant tin cans cut in half vertically and pressed into the dirt, with their entrances protected by sandbags. She followed the center aisle, which was flanked on either side by a long covered area and rows of buildings. She passed the men's quarters, the pharmacy, a small chapel, and the Red Cross station, the PX. In the center of the aisle, below a tall water tower, was a raised stage, empty now. The mess hall ran perpendicular to the stage. She paused at the open door of the long wooden building. Inside, it was divided in half. One side for officers, one side for enlisted. She found a table set with bread, muffins, a vat of American peanut butter, and a tub of butter. She poured a cup of coffee and gulped it down, hoping it would quell her pounding headache. When she emptied the first cup, she put peanut butter on a piece of toast and downed it with 8 ounces of milk. She instantly felt sick and ran for the latrines, but made it only halfway there before she vomited at the side of the PX. When there was nothing left to vomit, she moved cautiously back onto the walkway, made her way to Major Wendy Goldstein's office. Inside, the chief nurse sat at a desk behind a mound of paperwork, dressed in faded, pressed fatigues. Frankie stepped inside the office and saluted.
Second Lieutenant McGrath reporting as ordered, she said clearly.
Major Goldstein looked up. Her face and hair were both pale and could have given the impression of fragility, but somehow the opposite felt true.
What time is it, Lieutenant McGrath?
Frankie glanced at the black wall clock, which was protected by a black wire cage.
0803 hours, Major Goldstein.
The major pursed her lips.
Oh, good. I was afraid you couldn't tell time. When you are told to report to me at 0800, I expect to see you precisely at 0800. Are we clear?
Yes, Major, Frankie said. I was sick.
Don't drink the water or you'll spend your whole tour either vomiting or crabbing. Didn't someone tell you that?
I think... She stopped mid-sentence, drew in a sharp breath. She cocked her head to the left, listening. Then said,
Damn.
Frankie heard the distant thwop, thwop, thwop of incoming helicopters.
Are we under attack?
Not in the way you think.
She closed a manila folder.
Let's see what you're made of, McGrath. I'll assign you tomorrow. Be here at 0800 sharp. For now, it's all hands on deck. Report to Lieutenant Flint in the ER.
The emergency room?
It's not a cocktail party invitation, McGrath. Move.
Frankie was so confused, she forgot to salute. She couldn't even remember if she was supposed to salute. She turned and rushed out of the admin building, followed the covered walkway to the set of Quonset huts that made up the wards. Her new boots started to hurt her feet. At the helipad, marked by a red cross on a white circle on the ground, she saw 3 helicopters, each emblazoned with the Red Cross insignia, buzzing overhead. None had manned gunners at the doors. So these were the dust-offs she'd read about, unarmed medevac helicopters that transported injured men off the field. 2 of them hovered as the 3rd lowered. A medic and 2 nurses appeared almost instantly and began offloading men on litters. Moments after that chopper lifted up, another lowered onto the pad. More corpsmen showed up to offload the wounded. An ambulance drove up to pre-op. Frankie found the Quonset hut that housed the emergency room. Medics ran in and out, carrying men on litters. One lay screaming, his own severed leg on his chest. Another had no legs at all. Their uniforms were bloody, Some of their faces were still smoking from burns the medics or their friends had put out. There were gaping chest wounds. One guy, she could see, had a broken rib sticking up. Ethel stood in the midst of the chaos like an Amazon goddess, directing traffic, positioning the casualties, pointing out what to do with the wounded. She seemed unaffected by the chaos. More men followed her commands. There were so many wounded that some had to be left outside, their litters set on sawhorses, waiting for space in the ER. Frankie was overwhelmed by the horror of it, the screaming, the smoke, the shouting. A medic saw Frankie standing there and shoved a boot into her arms. She stared down at it, saw that a foot was still inside. Frankie dropped the boot, stumbled just out of the way, and vomited. She was about to vomit a second time when she heard, "Frank! Frank McGrath!" Ethel grabbed her by the arm. Frankie wanted to run. "I'm not trained for this." "We need your help." Frankie shook her head. Ethel touched Frankie's chin, made her look up. "I know," she said, pushing her hair back with a bloody hand. "I know.
In basic, they taught us how to wrap bandages and shave a man for an operation. I shouldn't be here. I..."
"You can hold a man's head. You can do that."
Frankie nodded numbly. Ethel took her by the hand and led her to the staging area in the ER.
"This is triage," Ethel said. "We assess here. We decide who gets seen and when. We treat the ones we can save first. That screen over there in the back? We put the expectants there. Men who probably aren't going to make it. We see them last. We can treat 5 gutshot wounds or amputations in the time it takes to handle 1 head injury. You understand? The walking wounded, those men over there."
She pointed to a group of soldiers who stood beside the screen with their fellow soldiers, talking, smoking, doing what they could to comfort the expectants.
"They'll be seen when we have time."
Ethel led Frankie to a soldier lying on a litter. He was drenched in blood and one arm was just gone. She looked quickly away.
"Keep breathing, Frank," Ethel said calmly. "Hold his hand."
Frankie positioned herself at the patient's side and forced herself to look down. At first, all she saw was the horror, the devastating amount of blood, the arm that had been severed at the elbow, revealing the white of bone and pink gristle and dripping blood. "Focus, Frankie." She closed her eyes for a second, exhaled, and then opened her eyes. She saw the soldier this time, a young black man wearing a dirty green bandana who looked barely old enough to shave. Very carefully, she took hold of his hand.
"Hey, ma'am," he said in a slurred voice. "Have you seen my buddy Steve-O? We were together."
Ethel snipped the uniform off of the young man, revealing a massive abdominal wound. Ethel looked up. Her eyes were tired.
"Expectant!"
she yelled out. 2 medics appeared and picked up the litter and carried it to the staging area behind the screen. Frankie looked up at Ethel.
"He's going to die."
"Probably."
Was this what Frankie had joined the army for? To watch young men die?
"We will save plenty of lives today, Frank. But not all of them. Never all of them."
"He shouldn't die alone."
"No,"
Ethel said, and gave her a tired smile.
"Go, Frank. Be his sister, his wife, his mother."
"But..."
"Just hold his hand. Sometimes that's all we can do. And then, come back here."
When he was dead, that was what Ethel meant. Frankie felt as if a giant weight were suddenly pressing down on her as she stepped around the screen. The soldier, Kid, was off by himself. She saw that he was crying. She approached him carefully, looked down, saw his name and rank.
"Private Frenette," she said.
It seemed to get quiet suddenly. She couldn't hear the screaming of the helicopters coming and going or the nurses yelling at one another. All she could hear was this man's labored, bubbly breathing. She kept her gaze averted from the horrible, gaping wound that showed his glossy intestines and dripping blood. She moved in close, reached down, took hold of his cold hand.
"Private Frenette," she said again. "I'm Frankie McGrath,
He blinked slowly. Tears slid down his face, mixing with dirt and blood.
"Have you seen Steve-O? Private Grand. It was my job to keep him safe. He just got in country 2 days ago. His mama and mine work at the same salon in Baton Rouge."
"I saw him," Frankie said, finding it hard to speak past the lump in her throat. "He's fine. He was asking about you." Private Fournette smiled, a little sloppily.
Something hurts, ma'am. I figure that shot is wearing off. And I surely could use a cold beer."
He started to shake. His hand and hers went limp, grew colder.
"Ma'am,"
he said.
"Yes."
It was a long time before he spoke, a shivering silence.
"I wish I'd have told."
He wheezed hard. Blood bubbled up from his mouth.
"Loved her."
"You'll tell her after surgery," Frankie said. "Right after they fix you up, I'll help you write a letter."
He paused, shuddered, and closed his eyes. His hold on her hand loosened. 1 minute he was there, holding her hand, whispering his regret, and the next moment he was gone. Mass casualty. That was what they called tonight, or actually Mass Cal. Apparently, since the recent influx of troops, it was beginning to happen so often that they didn't have time to call it by its full name. Frankie stood in the back corner of the Quonset hut that housed the ER. After 9 hours on duty, she was beyond exhausted, and her feet burned with blisters, but it wasn't the ache in her bones and muscles and feet that mattered. It was shame. How on earth had she thought she belonged here? That she had something to offer men who were grievously wounded? She'd been as much help as a candy striper. Tonight, she'd held scissors in hands that never quite stopped shaking and cut off t-shirts and flak jackets and pants, revealing wounds that she couldn't have imagined before today. She still heard patient screams inside her head, even though the ward had emptied a while ago. Casualties, she reminded herself. Back in the world, they were patients. Here, they were casualties. The army was full of terms like back in the world. That was how everyone referred to the life that they'd left behind. Frankie sighed heavily, heard footsteps, and knew it was Ethel coming to check up on her.
"Well, that was an ass-kicker," Ethel said, lighting up a cigarette. "And no, not every day is like this, thank God."
In her mind, Frankie nodded. She was pretty sure that, in fact, she just stood there, staring at nothing. Ethel put an arm around her.
"How are you, Frank?"
"Useless," was all she could say.
"No one is ever ready for this. The worst part is that you'll get used to it. Come on."
Ethel kept her hold on Frankie, led her through the camp. Frankie felt every one of the new blisters on her feet. Outside, the night air smelled heavy, like blood on metal. There was no moon to light the way. In the mess, she saw a few men sitting in the enlisted section, drinking coffee, and as they approached the O Club, she smelled smoke wafting through the beaded curtain. Music followed the smoke, infused it with memories of home.
"I want to hold your hand."
In the distance, she heard the whoosh of waves rolling in and out. The sound called to her like a siren song, reinflated her youth. Knights on bicycles with Finley, riding free, their arms outstretched, stars overhead. Finley. She'd felt his ghost beside her all night, seen his eyes in the face of every soldier whose hand she'd held. She pulled away from Ethel and walked alongside a coil of concertina wire, a barrier of razor-sharp spikes. In front of her, the sea. It was a glow of silver, a sense of movement, and the comforting familiarity of it, the salty tang in the air, called out to her, reminded her of home. On the beach, she sat down in the sand and closed her eyes. She felt the salt, tasted it,
the sea. No, not the sea. She was crying.
You can't be out here alone, Frank. Not all soldiers are gentlemen.
Ethel sat down beside her.
I'll add that to my list of mistakes.
Yeah. You gotta be careful. Over here, the men lie and they die.
Frankie had no idea what to say to that.
So, which is it? Ethel finally said.
Frankie wiped her eyes and looked sideways.
What?
Are you out here grieving the boys we lost, or your own piss-poor set of nursing skills?
Both.
That means you've got what it takes, Frank. We all went through it. Nurses back in the world are second-class citizens. And big surprise, they're mostly women. Men keep us in boxes, make us wear starched virgin white, and tell us that docs are gods. And the worst part is, we believe them.
Doctors aren't gods here?
Of course they are. Just ask them.
Ethel pulled a pack of cigarettes out of her pocket, tapped one out, offered it. Frankie took the cigarette. She didn't smoke, never had, but just now it gave her something to do with her unsteady hands and blocked out the smell of blood.
Why did you join the army? Ethel asked.
It doesn't matter anymore. It was a stupid, childish thing to do.
She turned to Ethel. Why did you join?
We all have a long story and a short story answer to that, I guess. Long story? After I got my nursing degree, I decided I wanted to follow in my dad's footsteps and become a veterinarian. I was headed that way when the man I loved shipped out. Short story? I followed him.
Her voice softened.
His name was George. He had a laugh that fixed everything.
And he...
died. And you?
My brother died over here, too. And I wanted to make a difference.
Frankie stopped, hearing the naivete in her words.
Yeah. That's why I re-upped for a second tour. We all want that, Frank.
Back in the world, when Frankie had told her friends that she'd hoped to make a difference over here, hoped to make her family proud, they'd rolled their eyes and acted impatient with patriotism. But out here, sitting beside this woman she barely knew, Frankie remembered the pride she'd felt on joining the army.
I'm sorry about your guy, Frankie said. George.
He was a real looker, my Georgie,
Ethel said with a sigh.
And for a while, I hated that I'd followed him here and lost him anyway. But I stuck it out, and now I'm glad I stayed. That's what I've learned, Frank. I am better and stronger than I ever thought. And when I go back to my daddy's farm in Virginia and get back into vet school, I know there's nothing that can stop me. I want it all, Frank. A husband, a kid, a career, a big old life that ends when I can barely get out of my rocker with kids and animals and friends all around me. You'll find out what you want over here, too. I promise.
Thanks, Ethel.
Now, enough seaside weeping. Do you drink, Frank?
Frankie didn't know how to answer that. She'd gone to fraternity mixers in college, and she'd had a few beers, and she'd had two shots of whiskey on her first night in Vietnam. But really, she was a good girl who followed the rules. She'd turned 21 in December. The age drinking was legal in California, but with Finley's death and the terrible holidays last year, she hadn't celebrated her birthday.
I have.
There's plenty of it over here, Ethel said.
Watch out. Take care of yourself. That's my advice.
I don't drink, but I don't judge either. Over here, it's live and let live. Whatever gets you through the night.
She got to her feet, put a hand down for Frankie.
Get up, Lieutenant. Brush yourself off and let's clean up and fill our bellies and then head to the O Club to blow off some steam. You just survived your first Mascal in Nam.
Frankie had never seen any human eat as fast as Ethel did. It was like watching a hyena gulp down a kill as predators closed in. Finally, Ethel pushed her empty plate aside and said,
I feel like dancing. You?
Frankie looked down at her barely eaten Salisbury steak covered in brown gravy and the overcooked green beans. Why had she taken so many mashed potatoes? Dance? How could she dance? Her stomach kept roiling and cramping. She couldn't shake the horror of what she'd witnessed tonight, nor could she accept her ineptitude. She was nauseated and ashamed. She pushed her chair back and stood up. The mess hall was full of soldiers in bloody fatigues. She was surprised at how loudly they talked and how often they laughed. Frankie wondered how anyone who'd lived through a mascal could get over it so quickly. She followed Ethel out of the mess. As they walked past the empty stage, Ethel told a story about the Christmas show at Dion when Bob Hope had entertained the troops.
I sent a picture of me and Bob Hope home to my dad. He said he hung it up on the bulletin board in the barn, told everyone that his girl was saving lives.
Frankie wasn't listening. She had never felt less like being around people. She started veering to the left, eager to escape back to her hooch. Ethel took hold of Frankie's arm, as if she'd read her thoughts.
Steady, Frank!
At the O Club, Ethel pushed the beaded curtain aside. The clattering sound filled in the beat of silence between songs. Inside, there was barely room to sit or stand. Men stood in groups, talking, smoking, drinking. A Stars and Stripes newspaper lay on the floor with the headline, McNamara's Line Fortified Along DMZ. The air was gray with smoke. How could they be here, as if nothing had happened, some still with blood in their hair, drinking alcohol and smoking?
Whoa, Frank, you're breathing like a racehorse. You don't want to dance, I get it. Hang on.
Ethel grabbed two cold Cokes and maneuvered back through the crowd toward the doorway.
Hey, pretty mamas, don't leave us, someone yelled out. Was it something we said? I'll put my pants back on. Come back.
The two women walked past the latrines and the empty shower stalls and came to the row of hooches. Opening the door, Ethel pretty much pushed Frankie up the steps from the wood-slatted walkway and into the dank, dark, foul-smelling hooch. She turned on the light and took Frankie by the shoulders and forced her to sit on her cot.
I smell like blood, Frankie said.
And you look like hell. It's a groovy combination.
I should shower.
Ethel handed Frankie a Coca-Cola, and they sat down on Frankie's cot, side by side, shoulder to shoulder. Frankie looked up at the horse and barn pictures tacked above Ethel's cot and felt a pang of grief.
My brother and I rode horses a few times. I loved it.
I got my first horse when I was 4. Chester the Chestnut. Ethel said. Mom used to saddle him and set me on his back and garden. I still have that dream of us sometimes.
She's
gone. Breast cancer. Please don't say you're sorry. I know it's true. How old are you, Frank?
21.
Ethel shook her head, made a whistling sound.
21. Hell, I barely remember that age anymore. I'm 25.
Wow, Frankie said.
You thought I was older, right? We age in dog years over here, Frank. And it's my second tour. By the time I leave, I'll have chin hairs and need bifocals. You watch.
Ethel lit up a cigarette. The gray smoke wreathed them, made Frankie suddenly homesick for her mother. She found herself softening just a little.
Where's Barb?
A kid from her hometown was brought in tonight with the crispy critters.
Not good.
She's sitting with him, I bet.
Crispy critters?
Burn victims. I know, we shouldn't call them that. You'll learn fast, Frank. We laugh so we don't cry.
Frankie could hardly grasp such a thing.
I don't think Barb likes me, Frankie said.
Can't say I blame her. It's not you, Frank. Barb has had a tough road.
Why?
Ethel gave her a look.
You have noticed the color of Barb's skin, I take it?
Frankie felt her cheeks burn. There had been no black girls at St. Bernadette's, no black families at St. Michael's Church or on Ocean Boulevard, none in her sorority or her nursing program. Why was that?
Of course, but...
But nothing, Frank.
Let's just say Barb is sick and tired and leave it at that. She's also one of the best surgical nurses you'll ever meet.
Ethel put an arm around Frankie.
Look, Frank, I know how you feel right now. We all do. We've been there. You're thinking you screwed up by signing up for NOM, thinking you don't belong. But let me tell you, kid, it doesn't matter where you're from or how you grew up or what God you believe in. If you're here, you're among friends. We've got you.
Frankie lay on her cot, her hair still damp from a lukewarm shower, and stared up at the ceiling. Hours had passed this way. She couldn't sleep. Her feet throbbed with the pain of new blisters. Barb's snores filled the small hooch, sounded like the ocean rolling in. Far away, there was the sound of gunfire popping. Ethel tossed and turned, her cot squeaking at every movement. Images from tonight's mass cowl ran through Frankie's mind, a kaleidoscope of horror. Torn limbs, blank stares, gushing bleeds, sucking chest wounds. One young man screaming for his mother. She needed to use the restroom. Should she waken one of her roommates to go with her? No, not after the night they'd had. She threw the covers off and got out of bed, stood there in the dark. She heard something scurry across the floor, and already she didn't care. What were rats to her after tonight? She dressed in her fatigues and slipped her stockinged feet into her boots, immediately feeling the raw blisters that had formed. Outside, the compound was relatively quiet. Some distant gunfire, an engine humming, a generator maybe, a faraway beat of music. Someone, somewhere, was listening to a transistor radio. She shouldn't go out. She knew that. It could be dangerous. Not all soldiers are gentlemen, Ethel had said, reminding Frankie that the army at war wasn't so different from the world. Still, she couldn't breathe in here, couldn't sleep, and her bladder ached with the need to be emptied. The horrible images she'd seen wouldn't let her go, and the heat was giving her a headache. She stepped down onto the hard-packed dirt and walked toward the latrines. Off to the left, a shadowy figure stood at a burn barrel, throwing things into the fire. The stench wafted this way. A narrow walkway spread over a ditch with coils of spiked wire on either side. She walked cautiously over the makeshift bridge and ducked into the women's latrines. When she exited the building, she smelled cigarette smoke and stopped. A lone, orange-gold light shone down from a post overhead, revealing a man standing not far away, smoking. She turned away quickly, stepped on something that cracked. He turned. The chest cutter, Jamie. In the ghoulish light, his handsome face looked drawn, even as he tried to smile at her.
"I'm sorry. You want to be alone," she said. "I'll go."
"Don't," he said. "Please." Frankie bit her lip, remembered Ethel's warning about men. This was a lonely place, hidden. She glanced back toward the relative safety of her hooch.
"You're safe with me, McGrath."
He held out a hand. She saw that it was shaking.
"Hell of a thing for a surgeon's hand to shake," he said.
Frankie moved toward him, but remained out of reach.
"You caught me on a bad night," he said.
Frankie didn't know how to respond.
"A friend from high school came through today. We played football together. He said, 'Save me, JC.'"
His voice broke.
"I haven't been JC in a long time. And I couldn't save him."
Frankie could have said the kind of thing she'd heard at Finley's funeral, the empty, shiny words of a stranger. Instead, she said,
"You were with him when he died. You can tell his family that he wasn't alone. That will mean a lot to them. I know, believe me. My brother died over here, and all we got back was another man's boots."
Jamie looked at her for a long time, as if her words had surprised him. Then he tossed down a cigarette, ground it out with his heel.
"Come on, McGrath. It's late. I'll walk you back to your hooch."
He moved toward her. She fell into step beside him.
On the makeshift bridge, he let her go first, and at the closed door of her hooch, he stopped.
Thanks,
he said.
For what?
Just being here, I guess. Sometimes it doesn't take much to save a man in Nam.
On that, he gave her a false, fleeting smile and walked away. 7. The next morning, when Frankie woke up, she was alone in the hooch. She dressed quickly and presented herself at admin at precisely 0800. She saluted.
Lieutenant McGrath, Major.
I heard you were as much help in the ER as a tiara, the major said, and opened a manila folder. A nursing degree from some small Catholic women's college and almost no clinical experience. And you're young. She peered at Frankie through black, horn-rimmed glasses. What on earth brought you here, Lieutenant?
My brother.
Never mind, I don't care. But I hope to God you aren't here to say hi to a brother. Major Goldstein pushed her glasses higher up on her nose. The Navy and Air Force won't even let a girl like you in, Nam. They require training. She closed the folder, sighed. Anyway, you're here. Unready, unprepared, but here. I'm assigning you to Neuro. Night shift. How much damage can you do there?
I'll do my best.
Uh-huh. Welcome to the 36th Evac Hospital, McGrath. Be the best version of yourself. Housed in a Quonset hut near the OR, the neuro ward was a brightly lit, domed space filled with Stryker frame beds. Frankie had never seen the specialized beds before, but she'd learned about them in school and in basic training. Beds for paraplegics, for patients with pelvic fractures, burn patients, or others who couldn't handle much manipulation. Two rows of beds were separated by a wide aisle. Metal tubing ran the length of each wall for hanging IVs. The amount of equipment at each bed was staggering. Ventilators, cooling blankets, monitors, IVs. Frankie didn't even recognize most of the machines. The overhead lights were blaringly bright. She heard the whoo-thunk of ventilators, the buzz of EKG monitors. In the front left corner, an older man in faded fatigue sat at a desk, writing. The only other soldier she saw, standing, was a corpsman at the far end of the ward. He was checking on a patient. Frankie straightened her posture and tried to look more confident than she felt as she walked over to the man at the desk.
Second Lieutenant McGrath reporting as ordered, sir.
The man looked up. He had the tiredest eyes she'd ever seen and a face that showed a history of acne. Heavily jowled cheeks blurred his jawline.
Francis, right?
Frankie, sir.
Captain Ted Smith, doctor. How much nursing experience do you have, Frankie?
My RN, sir. And some time on the night shift at my local hospital.
Uh-huh.
He stood up.
Walk with me.
He strode forward. At the first bed, he paused. Beside him lay a young Vietnamese man, his head wrapped in bandages, through which blood had seeped in a red-brown burst.
He's Vietnamese, Frankie said, surprised.
We treat the villagers who were brought in,
Captain Smith said.
Anyway, Frankie, every patient in here is brain damaged. Most have no pupillary response. You know what that means?
Before she could answer, he took a slim flashlight out of his breast pocket and shone it into the patient's eyes.
See that? No reaction. Fixed and dilated. You'd note that in his chart, along with the time and date.
He showed her where and how to make the notation, and then handed her the flashlight and walked on, took her past one young American soldier after another who lay naked beneath pale sheets, staring at nothing. Most were on ventilators. There were several Vietnamese patients.
This one walked into a rotor,
he said, at the bed of a man with half his head bandaged and one arm gone. The last bed was occupied by a black man covered in bandages. He writhed, babbled unintelligibly. Then he screamed as if in pain.
He's not comatose, but not fully conscious either. He has a chance at some kind of recovery. Most don't, honestly. We've developed the skills to save their bodies, but not their lives,
Captain Smith said. Frankie looked out over the many beds, a split sea of white and metal and men and machines, each one someone's son or brother or husband.
We monitor and change dressings and keep them breathing until they can see a neurologist at the Third Field Hospital. You'll learn to see subtle changes in their conditions. But this is an evac hospital. They won't be here long.
Can they hear me?
Good question. Yeah, Frankie, I think they can. I hope so, anyway. You can start an IV?
In theory, sir. She felt her own incompetence like a scarlet letter on her fatigues.
Don't worry, Frankie. You've got heart, I can tell. Skills, I can teach.
April 14th, 1967. Dear Mom and Dad, hello from the 36th Evacuation Hospital. I'm sorry it's taken me so long to write. It's hard to express the speed of life over here. I'm either terrified or exhausted most of the time. When my head hits the pillow, I'm out. Turns out you can learn to sleep through anything if you're tired enough. I've been focusing on improving my nursing skills, which were, to put it kindly, subpar. I work long hours on the neuro ward, where I've been assigned. I'm learning so much. I spend my shift shining bright lights into my patients' eyes, marking down any pupil dilation, or lack thereof, changing surgical dressings, suctioning wounds, monitoring ventilators, changing IVs, turning paralyzed patients every few hours, pinching or poking places on the bodies to see if they can feel pain. It is every bit as glamorous as it sounds, and Mom, you would definitely have something to say about how I look these days, but my skills are improving. Slowly. I've made two friends over here, Ethel Flint, an ER nurse from Virginia, and Barb Johnson, a surgical nurse from Georgia. They're keeping me sane. My superior, Captain Smith, is great, too. He's from a small town near Kansas City. You would love him, Dad. He collects watches and loves backgammon. I miss you. Send me news of the real world. All we get for newspapers over here is the Stars and Stripes, and the only radio is Armed Forces Radio. Suffice it to say that we don't get news about the latest Burton-Taylor brawl. Please write back soon. Love you. Frankie. The relative quiet of the neuro ward was the perfect place for Frankie to improve her nursing skills. She was able to breathe here, to concentrate, to ask questions of Captain Smith, and with practice came the start of confidence. There were few emergencies on this ward. The patient's wounds had already been cared for in the OR. The patients were comatose, but most had other wounds that needed care too. The quiet gave her time to think, to process, to read the detailed care notes she wrote after checking each patient. The job at the 36th EVAC was to get the patient stable enough to go to a field hospital for treatment. Pain management was the task Frankie took the most seriously. Because her patients couldn't speak, she took extra care with each one to assess and assume their pain levels. From a distance, the ward seemed to be full of young men stuck in the hinterland between life and death. Most had little or no reaction to any stimulus, but as Frankie learned the skills it took to care for these men, she began to see them not merely as bodies in pain, but as men hoping for something more. Each soldier made her think of Finley. She spoke to them softly, touched their hands. She imagined each patient lying here, locked in the black void of a coma, dreaming of home. Now she stood at the bedside of 19-year-old Private Jorge Ruiz, a radio operator who had saved most of his platoon. Captain Smith had placed him in the back of the ward, which meant that he wasn't expected to live long enough for transfer. "Hey, Private," Frankie said, leaning down close, whispering directly into his ear. "I'm Frankie McGrath. I'm one of your nurses." She pulled a stainless steel cart closer. It was stocked with sterile gauze, peroxide, and adhesive tape. She'd need to replenish it all for the shift change. The overhead lights blared down on her, making her eyes ache. She reached gently for his leg, wondering if he had any sensation of being touched as she unwrapped the blood-stained gauze. "This might hurt," she said gently as she began to pick at the crusty, dried gauze, pulling it out of the pink, jagged wound. She wished she could dampen the gauze to make it free easier, but this way the wound bled, and bleeding was good. Beneath the gauze, she looked for blackened bits of tissue or green pockets of pus. She leaned forward to smell the wound. All normal, no infection.
Looking good, Private Ruiz. A lot of the boys in this room would be envious of a healing like that, she said as she rebandaged the wound.
Beside her, the ventilator rose and fell, whooshed and thunked, inflating and deflating his sunken chest. A commotion at the doors interrupted the quiet. Two bloodied soldiers in dirty, ripped fatigues walked into the ward, shoulder to shoulder.
Ma'am, one of them said, stepping close to Private Ruiz. How is he?
He's in a coma, she said.
Will he wake up?
I don't know.
The other soldier stepped in beside his friend.
He saved our lives. He wanted to go home and be a fireman, some shit-ass border town in West Texas. I told him he'd never pass the test.
He looked at Frankie.
I gotta tell him I was just yanking his chain.
He's hanging on, she said. It was all the hope she could offer, and it was true. With life, there had to be hope.
Thank you, ma'am, for taking care of him. Could we take a picture of you with him, for his mama?
Of course, she said quietly, thinking how much a picture of Finley would have meant to her family. She moved closer to the young man, held his limp hand in hers. The soldier snapped the shot.
He's lucky to have friends like you, Frankie said. Tell his mother he wasn't alone.
The soldiers nodded solemnly. One of them took a pin off of his pocket, an insignia of some kind, and handed it to Frankie.
Thanks, ma'am.
He stared at Ruiz for a moment longer, then left. Frankie pocketed the pin and looked down at her patient.
You have some good buddies, she said, replenishing his IV.
By the end of her long night shift, it was all she could do to stand upright. With barely a glance at Debbie John, the nurse who'd come in to replace her, Frankie stumbled out of the ward. It was early in the morning, and already the sun beat down on her. She bypassed the mess hall, not hungry, and the O Club, no desire to party, and headed to her hooch. She could tell by the sound of small arms fire and helicopters in the distance that there would be patients incoming soon. She'd better sleep while she could. Thankfully, the hooch was empty. Barb and Ethel worked days, mostly. For weeks, she'd barely seen her roommates. Grateful for the relative quiet, Frankie untied her boots, put them in her locker, and lay down on her cot. She was asleep in minutes.
Rise and shine, princess!
Go away, Ethel, I'm sleeping.
Frankie rolled onto her side.
Nope, Babs and I have talked about it, and we are taking you under our wing. Wings?
She looked at Barb, who shrugged. Frankie groaned and put the pillow over her head.
Cool. Starting tomorrow.
Starting today, Frank. You've been hiding out with the Gorks for 6 weeks. We haven't seen you in the O Club in weeks. Who comes to Nom and plays with no one?
I'm learning to be a competent nurse.
That's what today's all about. Now get up before I pour cold water on you. Put on your fatigues. We're going on a field trip. Bring your camera.
Ethel yanked the blanket off of Frankie, revealing her bare legs. Grumbling, Frankie stumbled out of bed and dressed in a t-shirt and fatigue pants that were still new-looking, unmarred by bloodstains. There weren't a lot of bloody emergencies in Neuro. Ethel and Barb waited for her outside the mess hall.
We're off to see the wizard. Word is that no wounded are incoming, Barb said, smiling.
She handed Frankie an olive-green canvas boonie hat.
You'll need this.
Outside, the camp was blissfully quiet. No helicopters delivering wounded, no mortars exploding in the distance. Men were throwing a football back and forth as a water truck rolled past. Ethel and Barbara led the way to a 2.5-ton truck, a deuce and a half, that was parked near the gates of the hospital. They climbed up into the back, along with Captain Smith. Several men from an infantry unit stood among them, carrying rifles.
Climb in, Barb said to Frankie. They're not going to wait forever.
Frankie climbed up into the truck's bed and took a seat on the metal floor beside the gunner. The big truck rumbled to life, shook, started to roll forward.
"Where are we going?" Frankie asked.
"Medcap,"
Ethel said as the deuce and a half rumbled past the guarded gates and out into the countryside. Was it safe out here?
"The Medical Civic Action Program. We provide medical care to locals. I'm sure you've seen them in the wards. Captain Smith organizes these outings whenever he can. Says they remind him of his practice back home."
They drove through a village that was not far from the hospital compound, saw fatigues and uniforms and olive-green t-shirts hanging from laundry lines. And then they were out in the country, jungle to the left, dirty brown river to the right. A bunch of kids floated downstream on a tire, laughing and shoving each other. Frankie used her Polaroid and snapped a photograph of a young boy herding a black water buffalo along the water, and one of an old woman dressed traditionally in a long split tunic over slim pants, which Frankie had learned was called an ao yai, carrying a woven basket full of fruit. The soldiers standing in the back of the truck straightened, their guns aimed at the lush jungle in the distance.
"Stay sharp," one of them said, adding, "Snipers."
Frankie stared out at the jungle, lowering her Polaroid camera to her lap. A team of enemy shooters could be hiding out there. She imagined men squatted behind stands of elephant grass, their guns pointed at the truck. She scrunched down, held the hat on her head, started to sweat. The truck rumbled down a muddy, potholed road and through the green countryside. Evidence of war was everywhere. Burn scars on the land, sandbags, rows of concertina wire, explosions sounding in the distance, choppers flying overhead. In a huge patch of jungle, leaves were dying and had turned orange. Frankie knew it meant that the U.S. had sprayed the area with an herbicide, Agent Orange, to kill the vegetation and limit the enemy's ability to hide. She saw Vietnamese women moving through the rice paddies or walking in the tall grass, wearing their flowing ao yais and conical straw hats, carrying babies and toddlers as they worked beneath the hot sun. They drove upward onto a mountain and at last came to a village tucked on a small, flat plain cut into the lush hillside. Neat gardens were carefully fenced and homes built of bamboo stood on stilts. In this remote village, the people lived as their ancestors had, hunting with crossbows and rice farming. The village appeared to have been built around a beautiful but decaying stone building, a relic of Vietnam's contentious French occupation past. The villagers, mostly small, hunched over old men and women with thin necks and narrow wrists, their teeth blackened by constant chewing of beetle seeds, came out from their huts to stand in front of the deuce and a half in a straight line, their hands clasped, their heads bowed respectfully. Ethel started to rise.
"Be careful," one of the armed infantrymen said. "The VC are everywhere. They plant bombs on kids and old women. They could be in the bush."
Frankie looked around. Bombs? On kids? How would you know? How could you tell these people from the Viet Cong, whose hidden bombs had blown up so many soldiers? How did you know who was an enemy and who was an ally? She took a hard look at the line of villagers in their flimsy black clothes, noticing there were no young people, male or female, only the very old and the young children. Were there swords hidden in sleeves, guns tucked in waistbands?
"Come on, guys," Barb said.
"No use worrying."
"Let's get to work," Captain Smith said.
The medical team jumped down from the truck. Frankie was the last to step down into the red dirt. How were you supposed to protect yourself from invisible enemies? Captain Smith moved in close, patted her arm.
"You're a good nurse, Frankie. Go show him."
She nodded as he walked toward an elderly man who was no taller than a 10-year-old American boy with dark skin and black teeth. He smiled at the medical team. Deep lines crinkled his face. He drew them toward him with a crooked finger, then turned and led them up into the broken-down French villa. The stone walls were riddled with bullet holes. In several rooms, the walls had crumbled. Woven grass-like mats lay on the floor. A fire glowed in a large fireplace. In it, a black pot bubbled and popped, sending a rich scent of spices into the dank room. The old man picked up a large earthenware jug and held it up to Captain Smith. He said something that sounded like "Buck see come on" in a rickety voice. He took a long drink and handed the jug to the doctor. He wasn't going to drink it, was he? What was it?
"It means thank you, doctors, I think," Barb said. She was the second to take the jug after the doctor and drank deeply, then handed the jug to Frankie, who took it slowly. She eyed the crockery lip and slowly lifted it to her mouth. She took a small sip, surprised to find that it tasted sweet and sharp, a kind of wine. The old man smiled at her, nodding, said something in his language. Frankie smiled back uncertainly, took another sip. After the welcoming ritual, the team set up stations to help the villagers. Everything was communicated by hand signals. None of the villagers spoke a word of English. The medical team set up a makeshift clinic with a portable exam table in a bare hut with a thatched roof. Another table was set up outside with a tub full of soapy water for scrubbing lice out of children's hair and washing sores on their skin. Flies landed on everything, on hair, on lips, on hands. The driver of the truck handed out candy to the children, who gathered around him, clamoring for more. For the next several hours, Frankie administered to the villagers in the living area of the old villa. The villagers, young and old, waited patiently to be seen for a variety of ailments. Frankie dispensed worming pills, antacids, aspirin, laxatives, and malaria tablets. She checked teeth and looked in ear canals and listened to heartbeats. She was nearly at the end of her line of villagers when a small boy, not more than 5, sneaked in to stand beside her. He wore a short-sleeved shirt and shorts and had dirty feet and unevenly cut black hair that he'd plastered back from his face with red mud. He didn't speak or tug on her sleeve. Neither did he leave her side.
"What do you need, little one?" she asked when the last in her line of patients had been treated. He smiled up at her in a way that melted her heart. She lifted him up into her arms. He wrapped his arms and legs around her and gazed at her questioningly, said something in his language.
"I don't..." The boy slipped out of her arms and took hold of her hand, pulling at her. He wanted her to follow. Frankie glanced back. No one was watching her. Outside, Ethel was giving out shots, and Barb was cleaning an old woman's machete wound. Frankie hesitated. She'd been warned to be careful. The VC could be hiding anywhere. The boy tugged harder. He looked so innocent, so young, not someone to fear.
"Okay," she said.
He led her down a cracked stone hallway through which vines crawled between the crumbling stone tiles and spread out, tentacle-like, across the mold-blackened floor. At a closed wooden door that hung half off its hinges, he paused, looked up at her, and asked a question in his language. She nodded. He opened the door. Frankie smelled something rotten and foul. Inside, a candle flame illuminated a child lying on a grass mat covered in dirty blankets with a chamber pot not far away. Frankie covered her mouth and nose with a handkerchief and moved closer. The girl was adolescent, 13 maybe, with tangled black hair and sallow skin. Her left hand was wrapped in a dirty, bloody bandage. Frankie knelt beside the girl, who eyed her warily.
"I won't hurt you," she said, lifting the bandaged hand and slowly unwrapping it. The smell of rot assailed her. The hand had been mangled beyond recognition. Green pus oozed out of the open sores. In one finger, a bone stuck up through ripped black flesh. Black flesh. Gangrene. She'd read about this, but had never seen it. The boy said something in his language. The girl shook her head violently.
"Stay here," Frankie told the boy, carefully releasing the girl's ruined hand. She went through the doorway and down the hall, out to the sweet, fresh outside air.
"Captain Smith, over here, bring your bag."
She led the doctor back to the dark, fetid room. He crossed the stones quietly, his footfalls matching the rapid beats of Frankie's heart. He knelt by the girl, examined her injuries, and then sighed heavily.
She must work in one of the sugarcane mills. This is a roller injury.
What can we do?
We could send her to the Third Field Hospital. They have a Vietnamese ward, but these villagers are a self-reliant people. They won't want to let her go, and we can't guarantee her we'll come back. Amputation and antibiotics are the best chance she has to live. If we do nothing, the gangrene will spread and she'll die from the infection.
They looked at each other, but neither thought there was a question. They had to try to save this girl's life. I'll call for Ethel.
No, I want you, Frankie. Tell the boy to leave.
Frankie felt a surge of panic, but Captain Smith was already kneeling, opening his bag. He took out a syringe and administered a sedative. When the girl closed her eyes and went limp, Captain Smith said,
"Hold her down, Frankie,"
and pulled out a saw. The young Vietnamese boy ran. Dr. Smith administered morphine.
"Hold her by the forearm," Captain Smith said. "Hard."
Frankie held on to the girl and did her best to help. The amputation was so brutal she had to look away several times, but when the surgery was over and the girl lay still, Frankie carefully treated the stump and wrapped it in clean white gauze. When Frankie finished treating the amputation, she turned and saw a slim, elderly South Vietnamese woman standing against the wall with tears in her eyes.
"Maybe that's her grandmother," Frankie said softly.
"Give the antibiotics to her and try to explain,"
Captain Smith said.
"Show her how to wrap the bandage."
Frankie nodded. She went to the silent woman in the back of the room and did her best to explain what care the girl needed. The woman gazed up at her steadily, nodded in understanding, and then bowed deeply. Frankie gave the woman the antibiotics and gauze and then followed Captain Smith out of the building. As she moved toward the truck bed, she felt a tug on her sleeve. The little boy held out his small hand, unfurled his fingers. In his palm lay a smooth gray stone. He said something in his language, pushed it toward her. She had a feeling it was a precious possession.
"Is she your sister?" Frankie asked.
He smiled, pushed his hand at her again. She took the stone gently, not wanting to offend. Then she reached behind her neck to unclasp the St. Christopher medal she'd worn since her confirmation at 13. She handed the necklace to the boy, whose eyes widened in joy. She dropped the smooth stone into her blouse pocket and climbed into the back of the truck. As they drove away, the very old and very young villagers standing silently in a row, Frankie pulled the stone out of her pocket. A nothing little rock. Something she'd ordinarily ignore. In her palm, it became a talisman, a reminder that, hopefully, a girl would grow to adulthood because of their work on this day. Yes, the girl would join a generation of amputees who had survived war, but she could run and play and marry and hold a child in her arms.
"You did well today, Frankie," Barb said. "There might be hope for you after all."
Ethel took out a pack of smokes.
"This is step one toward getting our girl out of Nero."
Frankie took a cigarette and lit it up.
"What's step two?"
Barb smiled.
"Well, honey, we're still working on that.